Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight's conversation is in two acts. The first, with the Forum's own Rita Norton, who tells the tale of Margie, a young girl whose white privilege conceals the fact that she is a functioning illiterate, even as she moves her way through college. The second act is with Bill Mullins of the Forum, who details the path to incarceration that is set in motion when persons of color, absent white privilege, never achieve reading levels beyond third grade. Please note that in Act 1, Rita uses a bell cue to highlight specific points in the story. In Act 2, Mullins includes his own perspectives and points out the connection to local literacy battles. This show is recorded on December 3rd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. I'm Rita Norton, a member of the Forum Committee that organizes these platforms for the discussion of significant issues, especially those involving ethical values in the contemporary world. Today's speakers, Bill Mullins and I, are both members of the Forum Committee who work for justice causes, often in quite different ways. But both of us include education in our commitments to positive change. How we both happen to be talking today about white privilege and bettering early literacy achievement is a convoluted story that involves very little actual collaboration. I get to start with the story of Margie. This is about Margie. Let the children teach themselves was the title that I placed on a dissertation proposal back about 1976. It followed about 18 months of the absolutely most boring, most frustrating academic research of my life and had been imposed upon me by university requirements. I had read and studied what every so-called expert in the teaching of reading had to say about phonics, synthetic phonics, sight reading, whole language reading, etc., including those who were convinced that the best teaching of reading was a combination of all the techniques. The general agreement was that reading should be taught and taught in schools. Through that period, I was working with middle schoolers for whom some test had determined that they were not up to grade level. Nevertheless, at least three-fourths of them could speak with clear language and coherent thoughts. Long story short, all that study, together with varied experience, brought me to the conclusion that reading is magic, a gift to humans almost as precious as opposable thumbs. Reading is magic. However one learns to translate squiggles on paper or computer screen to meaningful thought, reading is important for moving people beyond their own personal experience, for enabling understanding that encompasses huge groups of people and potentially influencing even larger life groups. That reading is magic is the conclusion I drew a long time ago, and additional experience hasn't changed my opinion. Nevertheless, 40 years of brain science and education research and technological quantification of information may possibly have led to new working methodologies in the 21st century. In the meantime, however, the desire to be able to read and the conviction that a meaningful skill level can be reached and then stretched are probably still considered crucial for learning to read. The forum flyer states that I'm to describe one white child's decades-long route to reading proficiency. This is mostly a story about Margie's slow journey to reading. Let's get to it. Margie was apparently reading ready from a perfectly average age. Somehow, however, the actual process of reading beyond decoding letters to sounds simply did not take. Margie was born in 1941 in North Central Kansas at Cloud County Hospital. She was conspicuously healthy and lived comfortably with her two parents and her older sister in two- and three-bedroom houses and a couple of apartments until age 21 and a half. Regarding the bell. In the spirit of consciousness raising, I'm going to ring this bell when examples of white privilege occur. The more consciously white people recognize our own privileges, the more likely we are to recognize the lack of privilege for others. And the better we understand how privilege requires somebody else's lack of privilege, the more likely we are to engage in undoing white privilege. The more we engage in the undoing of white privilege, the more we resist its injustice, which can extend to resisting other injustices, .. White privilege, bad. Awareness of white privilege, good. Birth in a hospital is a privilege that includes medical care, special eye drops, and easy access to birth certificates. Living with two parents for over 21 years is also an advantage. And some privacy from other members of the family is at least convenient. Please do listen for other privileges Margie had in her first decades. A little genealogy. Margie's mother had attended college for three semesters in about 1929-1930. Then Margie's mother, Yvonne, quit college to work for her father Adam's law office in a small Kansas town. Margie's maternal grandfather, Adam, was not a child of privilege, other than by having a sufficient number of relatives willing to pass around among them the small child with only one functional leg. There wasn't much Adam could do other than go to school. So to school, he went. He did well. Margie's maternal grandmother, Marion, had been a teacher. Margie's father, Will, was a 1927 high school graduate who became a Kansas State Trooper in 1940 and continued to serve that function until 1950. Which is what prevented his service in World War II. In 1950, Will was able to return to his chosen profession, golf. Yes, I said golf. Will's father, Albert, Margie's paternal grandfather, dabbled, shall we say, in real estate, buying and selling small properties for most of his working years. Will's mother, Harriet, this is Margie's paternal grandmother, came from strong farm roots, which skills she continued to use all of her life. Margie's family was never actually wealthy, but they seemed to manage basic, consistent financial security. Her mother was primarily a housewife, and although her dad's working hours were long, Margie's father was able to be home just about every night. Margie's mother used most of her leisure time reading, mostly history. Her father spent hours reading the newspapers. Her older sister, Cecilia, who had begun reading at about age 3, was an avid reader of whatever she could lay her hands on. Obviously, reading was the norm in this family. Are you beginning to ring your interior bell yet? I'm sure KKFI would prefer not having to deal with this sound throughout my talking. When Margie began attending school, the exercise seemed more social than anything else. At least, her specific recollections from elementary school had more to do with relating to people than to actually learning school lessons. First, there was mischief-making, which pretty much stopped after kindergarten. Then there was art. Her techniques were criticized. And much more favorably, music. Margie was good at that. Mostly, however, grade school was being with other children, which, by and large, Margie enjoyed. One specific puzzling episode Margie recalled occurred while walking home from school in the second grade with another little girl. They were walking on the sidewalk when Margie's companion saw two Negro children walking in the street. She shouted at them, "Hey," pluralized N-word, "where are you going?" Margie's mother had instructed her not to use the N-word. Margie shushed her companion. Then, in an effort to be nice to the other children, she invited them to walk on the sidewalk with her and her companion. The children in the street didn't respond. They just started running. An interjection here. Margie attended elementary schools in small Kansas towns, and the schools were integrated. Unquestionably, white students outnumbered Negro students, but Margie had black classmates in probably all of her elementary schools. She didn't question it. This was the norm in the 1940s and at least into the early 1950s. Margie's family had moved two or three times before 1950. When Will returned to golfing for a living, the moves became more frequent. And for Margie, school continued to be primarily for socializing. In fourth grade, Margie had one friend she was especially fond of. Her name was Joy, and the two were inseparable. One day, Margie's mother, Yvonne, told her that she was going to get a new dress, and that Joy's mother would sew it for her. After they went to Joy's house for the fitting, on the way home, Yvonne pointed out to Margie that there was something different about the house. Margie didn't see much difference, but she didn't argue. The house was smaller than the house Margie's family lived in. The house was darker than Margie was used to. That was memorable, but also no big deal. Her rural paternal grandparents didn't have electricity either. What was most memorable was Margie's sense that there was something that her mother did not approve of. After that, Margie and Joy drifted apart, and the memory of that special friendship stuck with Margie. Margie made other friends, whose homes she visited, but without her mom. Marie's house was noticeably much dirtier than Margie's, with old food and peculiar places and lots of clutter. New friend Scarlett lived in a really small house with her two sisters and her mom. This house was much livelier than Margie's, and that made it fun. In fact, on a couple of occasions, a man not Scarlett's father, was in the house in the morning. Margie, remembering the fuss her mom had made about Joy's house, mentioned these differences to Yvonne, her mother. But somehow, Margie's reports about what seemed odd in other people's houses did not seem significant to Margie's mother. A move to a different town decreased the social focus of school and increased the focus on learning new things. About this time, Margie learned how to decode groups of letters as words and to interpret punctuation marks. When called on to read out loud, she could do so, much like singing the musical notations that her mother had taught her earlier. But this non-musical reading wasn't nearly as much fun. Adult Margie couldn't remember writing assignments in elementary school. In 1954, Margie's family moved to Kansas City, Missouri, a huge city by the family's standards. Sister Cecilia was excited to be moving to the big city. Margie's main impression of the new school was of overwhelming overcrowdedness. Nevertheless, she made a few friends, and her increasing involvement with music gave her a niche within those hundreds or thousands of people. A particular topic of kid talk that related to Margie's earlier experiences came up frequently at this junior high school in Missouri. This related to the fear of what was going to happen when Negro students started coming to the school. Margie used her relative familiarity with Negro students to contribute to the talk. She was puzzled by the fear, and she tried to reassure a few acquaintances that there was nothing to worry about. Classes were much more challenging than earlier, and although she began to struggle, she more or less kept up by listening closely and by being able to write reasonably well, one laborious word at a time. The classes Margie enjoyed were band and orchestra. By this time, Margie knew that she wasn't reading the way she was supposed to read. Skimming her eyes over the pages simply didn't result in the understanding that was supposed to happen. To manage reading assignments, she would labor over a page or two within them, reading the paragraphs out loud to herself until she got some kind of message from them. Of course, whole reading assignments were never completed. And she told no one. The lives and conversations of her mother and sister continued to navigate about reading and talking about the things they read. Margie listened very carefully. And she paid less and less attention to the social aspects of school, trying harder than anything else to keep her secret about not reading assignments. The strategy she started in high school and nearly perfected in college was to closely study two or three pages of reading assignments, imagining implications and coming up with a safe question or two. And it worked. She called herself a slow reader. She stopped worrying about the incompleteness of the assignments. And she got away with it until she was forced during her sixth semester of college to declare a major. A casual older friend told her that as an English major, if she truly did listen closely and could write, she could get away with not doing the reading. Pay attention and note the page numbers the professors referred to. It worked. Long story short, again, Margie became an English teacher. Grading compositions strictly for mechanics and teaching only literature that she had dealt with in undergraduate college classes. She was actually pretty proud of her ability to keep a whole 50-minute lesson going based on three open-ended questions to classes about the reading. But then there were the graduate classes teachers were supposed to take. These would only be done in summer school, of course. Margie had a special interest in U.S. literature, especially of the cross-U.S. cultural variety. She used her old undergraduate technique, listening to the professor and classmates, reading only a few pages of the assignments, and writing papers with absolutely no creative interpretations. She became so interested in so-called American studies, she stupidly put together an independent study that would focus on, are you ready for this, James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison. Just in case there's anyone unfamiliar with Baldwin or Ellison, they are two great 20th century U.S. novelists and essayists who happen also to be black. The old technique didn't work so well without a whole class of fellow students to depend upon. She had to take an incomplete for that class. Completing it was put off until the next summer. The next summer was 1969. Very highly motivated, on a sunny July day, Margie sat on the porch, trying to read significant chunks of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Suddenly, Margie realized that she had read 8 or 9 pages of the novel without looking back to find phrases that might explain the mystery of the clock that captured the narrator's attention. She was reading. A strong motivation, backed by the familial expectation that everybody can learn to read, had finally, finally made real reading possible. She spent the rest of the afternoon plowing through a section of Ellison's Invisible Man, wrote a reasonable paper that she entitled Mule Feathers. White privilege and a curiosity to understand what turned out to be racism brought our Margie to the magic of reading.
Thank you, Rita. One of the things that I enjoy being associated with the forum is that we poke around. And this is an example of poking around in a creative way. And so, as my friends on the forum committee know, I'm great for coming up with topics and slow to pull them together into programs. And this is probably the worst example of all of that. This topic, I had not actually figured out how I was going to cause to happen, and Rita, in her generous way, said, well, maybe you and I could do something together. And I had a aha moment, and I've not and regretted it one iota. And in fact, when I finally got a chance to read Rita's talk a couple days ago, it just really was very exciting for me to have the chance to kind of riff on that. And so you'll notice here in the title slide that I keyed on the Margie's paper title, Mule Feathers. And I actually did a little Google search to see if perhaps that was a term of art in the Ellison lexicon or whatever. Didn't find anything to that effect, but I thought the contrast of mule feathers fit well with the notion that what's going on with reading is magic. And that, in fact, the basic story of Margie is that the magic happens when we're ready. Doesn't happen if we don't have the curiosity and the persistence. And so if reading is magic, then perhaps we need to think about whether or not we have schools that incorporate the teaching of magic. And that's kind of the direction that I want to go. But before I do that, I want to fess up and maybe conduct a little test. I'm about 4 years younger than Margie. But I can recall precisely, in my 28th year, getting to the test that I could no longer bluff my way past. I had good grades, excellent grades, and was generally considered to be the smartest boy in my class, relatively small class. I had the benefit of going to Rockhurst, getting a great Jesuit education. I studied physics and math and philosophy and theology. I went to graduate school in physics. I love the idea of physics. But in graduate school, I found out I wasn't any good at doing physics. The only time in my entire academic career that I cheated on a test was the very last test I took in graduate school. It was a take-home exam in a basic upper-level physics subject. I had a book. The question was in the book. I was too embarrassed to take an F or a C or whatever I would have gotten if I didn't complete that one question out of 4 or 5 on the test. So I copied the answer out of the book. It was essentially the last official act in my formal academic career. But to this day, I don't want to pretend that I don't carry, in my perfectionist way, as some would say, a sense of how significant that was. But in listening to the story of Margie, what I realized was that in my own way, my story is identical to hers. I did all the academic things right. I read voraciously from very early age. Never learned grammar. Never, to this day. I finally figured out what semicolons were good for. And so that strengthened my writing because I write quite a bit. But to this day, I couldn't pass a test on grammar. But I can write because I write a lot and I care about communicating in writing. And I learned from my wife when I was 24 years old, writing talks, much like Rita gave for Marriage Encounter weekends, how to throw away 2/3 of the words I had a tendency to spill onto the paper before I was ready to figure out what was the core idea and communicate it to people in a way that they would resonate with. I'm still learning how not to talk so much, how to prune way I think. But what I realize is this idea of magic is a vital part of what's going on in our education world. And I want to talk about how it goes astray for those of us who just look at this from the standpoint of white privilege. Little survey. How many people, show of hands, recognize the term Hogwarts? Okay, and now keep your hands up, please. How many of you, if you haven't seen a Harry Potter movie, lower your hand? Or if you have seen one and you didn't put it up before, go ahead and put it up now. And if you haven't read a Harry Potter book, lower your hand. Okay, so most of us are familiar with this notion of Hogwarts, which is the school of magic in this mythical place in England. And it's all about young, brilliant children who happen to have this sort of unusual talent who are being kept track of until they reach the age where formal schools, the Muggle schools, no longer serve their needs, and they're spirited off to a special school of magic. And that idea, that allegory or metaphor, leads me to the conclusion that if reading is really magic, and that makes sense to me, then shouldn't every primary school feel like a Hogwarts to a first grader? And my guess is if you are a white child born and sleep in a crib where there's a book not very far away and you're read to when you're a child, you're almost certain not to have lost that sense of magic about reading, at least by the time you get to the first grade. But I think the story of Margie is not all that uncommon, even with respect to reading, certainly with respect to English composition and, you know, the stories that I told about, where it is true that you can work your way to very high positions of power and influence and have only a sneak by the pothole knowledge of the overall substance of English and composition and language and literature. And it is the essence of white privilege that as a system, we kind of let that happen. If you're lucky, by the time you're in college or you have your first job, you have a boss or a mentor who actually points out to you, there's some things you could work on here. And maybe you go to an online course, maybe you take a night school course, and in fact, you formally sharpen up. You get that encouragement to say, you know, I see you've kind of worked your way around this hard spot, but now's a good time to take that up. And so you take that course and you confront that thing you've never all read the whole reading assignment for, and you prepare and take the test. And what happens after that, and I'm sure everybody in this room has been through this, is your attitude and your confidence about what you're good at and what to do with your life goes up like this. But how many of us have ever shared that story the way Rita just shared that story? And what do we lose if we don't take the time to share that story? I want to talk now in some very concrete terms about the problem of literacy in our urban schools in Kansas City. And I'm going to tease out two different ways of looking at that and give some idea of the cost of not recognizing that every primary school needs to have a little bit of Hogwarts in it. And that, in fact, some of our schools are so challenged by the young people that show up at their door that they're out there doing Hogwarts every day. And so the question is, how many of you would recognize a Hogwarts school in Kansas City if you saw it? And how important it is that we take that into account. And how important it is that we take that into account. This is a report, and it's the results of a survey. Mark Bedell, the superintendent of Kansas City Public Schools, now in his second year, full year, did a listening amongst the community for the first 100 days that he was on board, and he sat down and wrote a report. And the purpose of the report basically was to say, here's my education philosophy, and here's how I fit into what I heard my constituents say is important to them. And there are a couple of things that are really significant about this. One is he didn't come in with an armful, I got the answers, and here's how we're going to do it. He had sense enough, and if you understand his background, it's pretty recognizable why, to say, I want to build on what's strength, and I want to find a way to either improve or fix what clearly needs to be fixed. As a result of his survey, he came up with two pictures of what the community thought was important. And I don't know if you can read this, it's kind of messy, but basically what this picture, which is what the majority of the parents who send their kids to Kansas City Public Schools see as needed, concerns having to do with security, with availability of caring teachers, of culturally conscious administrators, of not over worrying about discipline at the expense of education, and all of the problems that go with day-to-day life, if you don't have one of those relatively stable income and two-bedroom households that Margie's story talked about. But there's a second graph in this report And I would encourage you, if you're interested, it's online. I happen to have a hard copy if you'd like to look through it. And that is the picture, frankly, of a group of folks, about 90 folks, who showed up to a listening session in the Waldo area. And when I first saw these two graphs side by side, it was like a smack in the face. Because what Mark had subtly but vividly demonstrated was, if you live in the Ward Parkway corridor or in Brookside, the things that you look to for the school is, well, of course, my kids are going to get educated, but I want to make sure that it doesn't cast a bad shadow on my property values. And so if you look at the lists of the things that are around this circle and compare it to the circle on the previous page of the report, there's almost no overlap. This is what privilege looks like in Kansas City inside the boundary of the Kansas City Public Schools. It's not like you can look at this list and say, well, this stuff isn't important or it isn't significant or it isn't worth taking into account. But the question is, when you get to, okay, how do we make sure that our tax dollars are being used properly? And people come to the conclusion that, well, that Southwest High School building is sitting there empty, and it's our nostalgia point for the great days of KCPS, you know, when Calvin Trillin was a student. We really ought to be using that building. Now, the report that Dr. Bedell put together in the text says very clearly the challenge of the folks who are represented by this picture is so great, I don't have time. My administration is not going to have time to listen to a bunch of ideas about how I ought to be running a school so that I have a school in an empty building that meets the needs of white people. Unfortunately, that message was lost on the people who want that Southwest building to be a high school for the Hale Cook kids and the kids that are in primary schools and the kids that are in the lower grade Catholic schools who can't afford to go to St. Teresa's or Rockhurst. And so they're off promoting the idea of a school. And they're promoting it on the idea basically that, well, I have to be able to preserve my property values. And if I can't preserve my property values by sending my kid to a Kansas City public high school, I'm going to move to Johnson County. And there are a lot of dyed-in-the-wool Missourians who don't want to move to Johnson County. And so to them, and to, frankly, some rather deep-pocketed philanthropic groups, the idea of, frankly, my words, badgering the Kansas City Public School Board and the superintendent into making room for their idea is okay. Now, at that point, in Surge, the Show Up for Racial Justice movement here in Kansas City that came up after Ferguson, we talk about four levels of racism: malice, implicit bias, the stuff you do that you don't know you're doing. But then we go on to talk about systemic and strategic racism. Systemic racism is sidewalks in neighborhoods that have lots of middle-class white households in a far worse situation three blocks to the east on the other side of Truce. Strategic racism is payday loans, okay, and redlining and practices that have been designed and perpetuated over many years to basically lift the opportunity of building assets out of low middle income households, particularly those of color, and put them in the pockets of people who live in the corridor that wants to see Southwest High School open. And I'm not saying anything here that I think is not on the record. And I think all of us know there's enough of this to say this is a component. Okay, and you don't have to have a large number of people, if they're willful enough, to believe they have the right to take up the agenda of all the rest of us. And that's basically what's happening in KCPS right now. And so I want to talk a little bit now about how the system of education in the state of Missouri or state of Kansas, if you chose, presumes out of white privilege that that's okay. There is a second view, and I won't say that everybody who wants to see Southwest opened as a high school, they say all the right words. We want diversity. We want project-based learning. The people that are fronting this are not educators. So you kind of know that they made a field trip to San Diego and they read some books. And so they have a superficial idea, the kind of wouldn't it be good if we did. But if you scratch the surface, at least some of them have this view of what happens when you treat reading as magic for kids who live in stress all day long and are patient about how long it takes them for that light bulb to come on. Because they're a lot more like Margie than most of us in this room when it comes to reading. And it's now clear in the literature that if you're not reading on grade by third grade, and you're a black male, you have about a 40% chance of ending up in jail in your life. And anymore, if you end up in jail, there's a good chance that experience is going to dictate the rest of your life. Ironically, it may well be that in jail is where you learn to read. Now think about that. Because lots of these young black males have initiative, they have curiosity, they have desire, they don't have the tools to put those to good use. They don't find in the school the support for getting there. But by the time they finally are in a relatively safe place, and I'm not talking about the Jackson County Jail by any means, but in a relatively safe place like prison for any length of time, in fact, there is an opportunity to encourage people to use their minds to the extent that they can. And there are GD programs, and there are supplementals. So if you have an eagerness to learn, and it's finally a safe place to do it, it's a good chance you're going to start to really enjoy that in prison. And there's just a whole complex. Again, you can see all these various variables that basically somehow reinforce the notion that it's okay for people of privilege in this society to think that a fraction of us deserve to go to jail because we weren't able to pass a reading test in the third grade. And I dare say that nobody ever says that out loud until they get backed into a corner and you start poking on, well, why do you think this or that imbalance between opportunity is okay? Or why are you upset with me if I say it's not okay? And then, slowly but surely, well, those people, some variation on those people, comes drifting to the surface. The white privilege part is never saying that out loud until somebody puts you on the spot. And never having anybody in your circle, whether it's your family at Thanksgiving or the parent-teacher meeting in the school your kids go to, raise these issues. So let's go back to the question. Would you recognize the Hogwarts if you saw one in Kansas City? And I'm going to tell you, I know of four or five. I didn't really realize that's what I was seeing until I sat down to think through it, taking the lead from Rita's insight about reading as magic. In my experience being in classroom with young people for whom just keeping their attitude afloat was a daily challenge, but seeing the curiosity, just not seeing it in books and sitting quietly reading books in libraries, that I had this realization that, yes, reading is magic, and the people who work to keep that possibility alive are the single most important educators in this community. And I want to show you now how the system of education that we have works to snuff that out. This picture happens to be of Benjamin Banneker Charter Academy of Technology, Meyer Boulevard and Rock Hill Road. It's a former church. So its auditorium is the sanctuary. You can see that on the left in the picture. And it has, like many churches of the day, a school annex. And it's in that school annex that the classrooms for this school are held. This is from their website. Children learning to be children. I started going to Banneker in 2012, and it wasn't very long, frankly, before I had been in that building when the light bulb came on for me that part of the reason the kids are so energetic in that building is because they're not learning at play at home. For a variety of reasons, it's not safe, or they're not adequately supervised. When they go home from school, to go immediately go outside like I did in my neighborhood with my friends and play ball and run around and go from neighborhood to neighborhood and ride our bikes and all the things. And the insight that part of the reason I was in classrooms with 50 kids my entire primary year. We did not have disruption. And it wasn't because we were less energetic than any other classroom full of kids. I think ultimately it was because our energetic stuff happened outside school hours and during noon hour. And I came to realize just how important it was, how much learning went on of the casual social type and the sports type that allowed me to be able to come into the classroom and be reasonably behaved and know that, well, if I got out of line, the entire adulthood was going to recalibrate me. But even the most rambunctious kids that I went to school with, we didn't have in-school suspension. We sure as heck didn't have out-of-school suspension. But if you sit in meetings with educators these days and folks who think they're helping schools, oh, we're off studying suspensions, and because suspensions are the first step on the road to jail. No, snuffing out the possibility of reading is the first step, and the second step, and the third step. And for some of our young people, it happens over and over and over again. And what white people do, and researchers in universities, is we do studies. Am I running out of time, Rita? We do studies to convince ourselves that this is somehow an academic thing. Well, I want to tell you that at Benjamin Banneker, this is a very real people caring about young people, where they're at, and that's what's important. Quickly, Benjamin Banneker is the oldest charter school in the Kansas City public schooling system. It's been around for 18 years. It's a safety net school. It has an open door policy in terms of kids getting into the school. For the last 3 years, that means 47% of the kids on day one in the new school year were not in the school the previous year. You can imagine how that affects their scores on the MAP system. They were doing pretty well up until 3 years ago, and they continue to do well with the students who are there year over year, but this deluge of unscheduled kids has caused their scores to drop dramatically. And this fall, UCM announced that they're withdrawing the charter. Some of us intend to do something about that. And it became particularly salient a few days later when the KCPS scores were revealed and it was reported that they had lost about 6 percentage points. And it was all around the issue of mobility and attendance. Now, I will tell you that school administrators, unless you live in a white small town somewhere, have very little control over mobility and attendance when 40% of the kids are in more than one building every year. And that's true of the whole of KCPS. So we have this huge population of kids and disrupted families that are sloshing around between public schools and charter schools. And what I will tell you is there's probably 6 to 10 of those schools that are doing the Hogwarts mission. And the system that the state of Missouri uses to evaluate performance makes absolutely no recognition of that. If it did, we would not be in a position of taking a building full of people who for 18 years have figured out how to meet these kids where they're at and keep the doors open and say, well, it's okay to disband that and send those kids somewhere else. White privilege is me having to stand up a couple weeks after this appears in the newspaper and stir us all up about no. So with that in mind, I'm going to let Rita finish up on Margie's story.
Actually, I'm not going to. It's not important. But it is important to let you have a few minutes for asking questions.
This is for Bill. Apparently, industry now is voicing its opinion that what it wants to see from its students coming into industry is two things. And the two things are the ability to make analysis and the ability to get along with coworkers. So in other words, a sense of questioning, number one, and the ability to get along with coworkers, number two. So how does the current school system and Dr. Bedell aid those two goals that industry is asking for?
This is my view, and it's couched in experience earlier this year in developing the current strategic plan for KCPS. And I was on the subgroup where we talked about a top-level goal having to do with critical thinking. Basically, if K through 12 schools can actually teach critical thinking, then presumably they would reflect that demand in the marketplace. I have huge problems with that. Spend time around these organizations in the marketplace and watch them do critical thinking, and they don't understand it. Now, what's happening that's promising is project-based learning. Project-based learning is where you work with a group of your peers on a practical task. We have a lot of that going on in the after-school STEM world right now. And I keep pointing out to my friends at UMKC and elsewhere, you better get with the program because we're training kids to come in expecting employers who understand that what they're asking for, they have to play a part in too. So my point would be that the schools are getting out ahead of preparing young people for those skills. I won't say across the board, but enough of them to the point where we're going to have to deal with the reality that employers, whether they're in government or education or business, aren't walking the talk yet.
Question would be to either one of you wants to answer it. I was struck by your example about the Southwest High School. My son went there for a year, years ago. These people are concerned about their property values. And it's a very fundamental question in American society today more than ever. How do you convince the privileged people that if they make it possible for the underprivileged to make progress and make something of themselves, that it will also raise property values? How do we get the privileged to understand this? This goes to the heart of what's going on in Washington and everywhere else.
Craig, I'm going to say something contrary. Frankly, I think we tried that, and the flaw in that argument is the notion that raising property values is what this country is all about. I've been reading a book on Washington and Adams and Jefferson in the period before the Revolution. Washington, particularly, if you don't know his story, he set out to basically survey the west of the Alleghenies and prepare to get wealthy, owning a lot of land that eventually would be worth something to sell. And it was perfectly understandable in the economics of the day. It is not understandable today that we're simply going to rely on how much to pay for a piece of land to figure out how much security a person is entitled to. I think we have to, in fact, work with alternative definitions of security with people who aren't obsessed with owning land, and then create a model that draws people to it because the planet is going to require us to get there whether we like it or not. Sir.
I don't know how I would end up how I would end up feeling about the Southwest thing, seeing a lot of signs about uniting at Southwest. But I, my kids are much older now, in their 50s, and we don't live very far from Banneker. And I've been keeping up with what's been said. I was wondering if you have any feelings about, since Banneker is a charter school and the governor wants to push charter schools, if that might include some relaxation on how you can maintain a charter school.
In trying to rally some support for the argument that the Hogwarts solution at places like Banneker and Genesis and De La Salle is an important part of a versatile public education system, my thinking is going along the lines of recognizing that if you take all the charter schools, the 20-some of them, you really, and lay them out on a spectrum, social engineering, the no-excuses model on one end, and meet the kids where they're at. Every child gets a chance to learn. That, there's two buckets. And the governor's idea of charter schools is over here with the social engineering piece. And not very far behind the social engineering piece is the for-profit school piece. So I think we're at a point, and Kansas City is in a good position. We've been doing this charter school stuff long enough to take a critical look at how it's actually working, as opposed to all of what all the papers and the Betsy DeVosses of the world say it ought to be doing. We have real concrete experience with which to make our own assessment. And I'm not even going to predict the answer. Okay, I think there are kids who will benefit from going to a rigorous school where no excuses, but probably not all the way to eighth grade. And over time, I'd like to think those schools just merge into being ordinarily competent schools like the one I went to.
So I think that your analogy of Hogwarts and, you know, reading being magic is very appropriate for my next question. I think that in your UU forum, she kind of alludes to it, but it mentions preschools, right? And I'm not sure if I heard you talk about preschools or not, but how you said that Hogwarts kids sort of, they can't meet the needs of, you know, those kids, and then they go on to Hogwarts. What happens before Hogwarts, right, in preschools, I think that it's just setting these kids up five steps behind, because if you look at the cost for preschools, if you look at the dividing line and the hike in the Kansas and the Missouri side, I think that we really have to look at the starting point. And so my question to you is, what information do you have on preschools?
I have the good fortune to being a member of the education subcommittee of the Kansas City, Missouri Community Health Improvement Plan. The goal structure that we're working under right now is very much one that we heard from the community, much like that left-hand side pie chart that Dr. Bedell put together when he did his listening session. Early childhood, actually prenatal care. You know, we have if you are born to a woman of color in the zip codes where people die 10 to 15 years early, there's twice as much of a chance that you will die in your early years, and there's twice as much a chance that your mother will die in your early years. The difference around health and the conditions of health and the adversities, the opportunity blight, is all of a piece. And so there is work in the health department under a notion called culture of health, which says you can't look at any one of these things separately. So I did not go into that, but there's no question that school starts for these most at-risk children at conception. We have to create a climate. Again, I think the good news is that there's enough will and experience with places like Operation Breakthrough and others. We have examples of how to do these things. What we need now is enough people who look like us to stand up and say, let's do this comprehensively. I was in a conversation the other night with teachers from Olathe Public Schools and Blue Valley Public Schools and Wyandotte County Public Schools. This is not just a Kansas City, Missouri KCPS. It's Hickman Mills and it's This is just part of how we get to be a metropolitan area that looks out for ourselves and builds human capacity for everybody. We can do that, but we've got a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Bill. However, we both get our very own U.S. Union-made form.
Maybe we should hand them to each other.
I do, too.
Thank you, Rita.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Next week's forum will be Dr. Sophia Kahn, local activist, organizer, and worker for refugees in the Kansas City area, and a really, really, really fine speaker.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, White Privilege, Motives, Expectations, and Bettering Early Literacy, with Bill Mullins and Rita Norton. This program was recorded on Sunday, December 3rd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.